Marion, you know me, I like learning new jokes. I've got a wide range of jokes about cheeses. I've also got quite a few jokes about umbrellas, but they usually go over people's heads. Hey, everybody, it's a Lovecraft show. My name's Mr. X-Stitch.
And I'm Marion. Crikey, that was a
You're
real
so
dad
positive
joke.
about my jokes, and they are so dreadful. I think if we put together all of my dad jokes into 5 minutes of pure hell, it would show what a resilient person you truly are, Marion.
A compendium of Jamie's jokes. It'd be
If
really
anybody
lovely.
has got any dad jokes, I'm always keen to hear new dad jokes. I think sometimes it's I'm part of like the PTA at my school, and we have a notice board. Not my school, at my daughter's school, and we have a notice board out the front. And I wanted to do like a dad joke of the month and just stick one up on the notice board as like a gift to other dads, so that they would be empowered, because it's all we've got, that and dancing. Did I tell you about how like it was only when I became a dad that suddenly my dancing made sense? Because it was like, oh my God, I've been doing like dad dancing since I was like 9, and now it only
Dad
makes sense.
dancing. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, my favorite, Jerry's favorite one from when our kids were small was that whole thing about what was a frog's favorite fizzy drink. It's a Coca-Cola. But you see,
Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola. But no, truly, truly, if lovely listeners, you have any dad jokes for Jamie, please send them to us. Please email us at show@lovecrafts.com. Let's face it, we need help.
I'm going to share Mary's, because they don't do mum jokes. Like, why are dad jokes a thing and mum jokes aren't a thing?
Because we don't need to, Jamie, that's why.
You're just so hilarious. Mary, my beloved, has got her favorite joke is what's orange and sounds like a parrot?
I
A
don't know
carrot.
what's. Oh, I love it. Do you know what my
Yeah.
favorite one is? My
Go on.
signature joke. Did you hear about the cross-eyed schoolmistress?
Go on.
She couldn't control her pupils. But I have to stop you because I
Because
will
people are unsubscribing from the podcast. No,
No, because I want
because.
because we have a fantastic person on the show today, and I love this woman so much. The first time she came on the Lovecraft show was season one, I think. Was it season
It
one?
was. Yeah.
To talk about one of her gazillion books that she's written, which was A Short History of the World According to Sheep. And it's an astounding read, and you'll hear us talk about it on this show. But Sally Coulthard, one of the most fascinating writers in the living world. And what I love about her is she writes a lot about craft, and that's the connection we wanted to make with her today. That's what we're talking about today, about endangered crafts, crafts that are no longer popular and are losing subscribers by the moment. So it's a very interesting conversation. I think she's a genius. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, so A, the conversation's really interesting, and it's interesting to understand how some crafts are sort of becoming extinct for reasons that make sense. So I think one of them was like hand blown sheet glass. Like that was the only way to make it once. Now you can do it with machinery. It makes a lot of sense, and that's understandable. But then there are other crafts that are much more profound, that are just, hand crafts that we've sort of forgotten. And when we forget about those crafts, we forget about how civilizations are made. And that's not even, I'm not even hyperbolizing there. That was a thing that we talked about. Thing I love about Sally as well, though, is she claims that she doesn't know very much, and then the minute you say something, she's got about 15 interesting facts to just
She
drop on you immediately.
knows everything. She is the woman that you need on your quiz team. She's the woman that you could talk
Interesting.
to for 1,000 hours. I could talk to her for hours and hours. But luckily, we've
Yeah.
only got an hour or so to talk. So you won't be falling asleep. But you do need a cup of tea and some biscuits so that you don't have to move from where you're sitting now. You just settle
Yeah.
down and listen to a very interesting conversation with author Sally Coulthard. Sally, I'm just loving all the videos of the ducks and the little running ducks going to bed. How cute!
I know, they're super cute, aren't they? Yeah, I'm really good. I'm kind of floating through life at the moment, just kind of seeing where things take me. Especially kind of, I'm trying to think if we have we spoken since COVID and all that kind of. When was the last one you
Well, we did. Yeah, we did. But the thing was, with that one, it was like, it was panel one, so it was a bit crazy, wasn't it?
Oh, that was really fun. Yeah. I just, I think because the kids are a bit older now, which is massively freeing when the kids aren't quite so kind of, I know, Jamie, you're right in their kind of like eye of the storm. Yeah.
I'm in the depths of it at the moment.
As they all get a little bit older, kind of life stuff starts to come back to kind of normal again. And then you have to really think about what you want to sort of do the next kind of decade or whatever. So I've just been really, really pushing myself with my writing, doing much more kind of detailed research and academic stuff and following the things that really interest me. So going lots more into kind of archaeology and anthropology and folklore and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just fascinating. I just feel like there's so much to learn and there's just not enough time.
Absolutely.
And I'm also kind of tempering that with just spending loads of time outside and really throwing myself into the garden. But I have decided that gardening is definitely something that hits you in middle age. It's like, I couldn't have cared about gardening until I was about 40. And then suddenly I've become obsessed with gardening and kind of being outside and faffing about in the flower beds and veg gardens and stuff. So, yeah, it's just lovely. I'm very happy.
Do you think it stems, like, did you have strong gardening influences with your parents?
My mum was a brilliant gardener, actually, sort of thinking, and she still is a brilliant gardener. And my dad's a hugely practical person. And so he was always making beautiful kind of, he was a wood, proper woodworker or a fine furniture maker in his retirement.
Wow.
And so he would make, and it would take him 5 years to do anything, but he would make really beautiful benches or an amazing, like, he'd make mum lovely kind of sculpt, plant structures and supports for the garden and stuff. So
how good was his shed? I bet his shed was good.
I mean, they're still both alive. I'm touch wood. I'm so lucky enough. And they're both still really active. So dad has this huge shed at the bottom of their garden, which it's his workshop really, which he had. I mean, there's so much woodworking stuff in there, you know, lathes and planers and reducers or whatever they're called. And I mean, he's just amazing. And mum's just brilliant. She carries on doing all the gardening stuff. So, you know, your parents are really influential. And I've always said that my mum and dad and their kind of creativity has been a huge part of kind of like my interest in creative stuff. I'm sure it's the same for you guys.
I've seen that with my wife. Don't call her Mrs. Xstitch. Because, you know, we've moved around quite a lot in the past few years, but we've been in this house for like 2.5 years now. And it's our garden. We rented a few times. But she, her mum's got an amazing garden. And Mary's now just gotten into gardening. And she's absolutely thrilled by it. You know, she's particularly now that everything's, you know, paying off. You're getting the rewards for your efforts now. And it's like every morning she goes out there. Every evening she goes out there. And it's, if you can connect with it and connect with nature in that way, I think it's quite profound. I think it's something that you, it hits you at your very core.
I totally agree with you. And I twigged only recently that actually there are certain periods in your life where you just can't garden or it's really difficult to and it's really frustrating. When the kids were really little and I was trying to do veg gardening and trying to be self-sufficient then, and I was just kind of constantly thwarted because I just didn't have enough time. And there's, you know, a garden is needs as much time as kind of a job or children, or, you know, if you want to kind of have a really beautiful or really productive garden. And so only recently have I kind of been able to really sort of give it the attention it deserves, and it's reaping rewards like you said, Jamie, that, you know, massively kind of satisfying.
I'm rubbish at gardening, and I think I used to love it. I went through a phase and I really loved it, and we had a veg patch, Jerry and I, and it was really great and we loved it and loved it. And then we moved house to the house we're in now, which has, I don't like the garden. And we had this crazy neighbour who used to come out and shout and stuff at the children. So I didn't used to go in the garden very much, yeah. And so now I hate the garden. And I have horses that live somewhere else. And so I spend all my time outside, but with horses somewhere else. So I never go in my garden. And I know, Jerry says he feels that gardening is calling him. So he will become a gardener. But I mean, it's one of those great crafts that, you know, you have to take, you tend it, you add your own personal touch, and you, I mean, I think it is almost a craft because you lovingly tend it and look after it and you produce what you want to produce, don't you? It's one of those things where if you want to grow veg or you want to grow flowers, or and people are so passionate about it and so enthused by it. It's a labour of love, isn't it?
I've never thought about it as a craft before, but I think you're absolutely right, Maren. I think that there are so many similarities between kind of mastering gardening and mastering a craft to do with kind of understanding your materials and, like, you know, learning through mistakes and sharing skills with other kind of like-minded people. And it's a kind of community, isn't it, as well, that you, and it's just kind of, it's a never-ending process that you never really learn all of it, but you get better and better and better at it, so you feel like you kind of master it. I think that's a brilliant way of thinking.
It's lovely.
Do you have a sort of definition in your head of what craft is?
I've thought about it. I've read a couple of books that have kind of been really influential. So obviously things like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is a classic, which is about quality, about whatever you do, you do it to the best of your ability, and at the heart of things has got to be kind of quality, whatever that means, i.e., quality of thought or using brilliant materials or, you know, not kind of bodging and all that kind of stuff. And I love that. And that sort of, so that's the kind of philosophy for me of kind of craft. And then I often sort of think about, like, what's the difference between craft and art? Because they're often put in opposition with each other to kind of create a definition of what craft is. And I suppose craft is often about the end result, whereas art is often about the process. And that in art, you're trying to convey a meaning, and that if the end result is beautiful, great, but that's not the kind of purpose of it. Whereas with craft, you're inherently producing something useful at the end of it. Well, hopefully you're producing something useful at the end of it, but that there's kind of beauty in the process, and, you know, lots of things kind of feed into that. I think, you know, that you have a kind of relationship with the materials that you're working with, or you have a kind of expertise. It's not kind of mass manufactured stuff. There's always a kind of individuality to the stuff that you're doing, and that the kind of human spirit is in the thing that you produce. I mean, that sounds like a kind of highfalutin answer, but, you know, that craft is a really important, I've always thought it's such an important area of kind of human life and human existence. And it's so central to kind of who we are. And, I know we're kind of Homo sapiens, as in thinking people, but we're also kind of Homo habilis. We're, like, you know, our ancestors were makers. And that thing about turning materials into something useful is absolutely at the kind of core of who we are. And I love that. I just think that's one of the things that kind of, it doesn't set us apart from other animals. Some other animals make tools and, you know, do stuff like that. But, you know, it really is kind of, it defines us as humans. So I find that really,
that's so interesting. Yes, because, I mean, so many animals make things to use them as tools, but they've got a reason, haven't they? I mean, so they really have, like, a birds that use tools, I mean, nests, or those horrible butcher birds that impale things on stalks of things. But craft is about the journey to making something for a reason. Also, art has a purpose. I mean, I suppose craft has a purpose, but art has a message, maybe. That's the difference, isn't it?
Yes, I think, actually, you know, like, art and craft are kind of set in opposition to each other often, as if they can't be one and the same. But I think there's so much artistry in craft, and there's so much craft in art, that often they're kind of like, they're like two circles that overlap a lot of the time. You know, because I know lots of artists who produce really beautiful, like ceramicists who produce really beautiful things that are also happen to be useful. But, you know, primarily their purpose is to kind of convey a message or say something about what it is to be human, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas craft, I like the kind of practicality of craft. I like the sort of pragmatism that's behind it.
Absolutely.
That really appeals to me.
I think there's a holy triumvirate, if that's the right word, because we haven't talked about design. And we talked about this when we interviewed Brenda KB Anderson the other day. And I listened to a talk a long time ago about the difference between art and craft and design. And if I can just point out my philosophy for a sec, I think craft is where you pay attention to the manufacture of something and you hone your skills, which is why gardening is a craft, isn't it? Because you start off with a garden and you learn which plants work in which areas and which conditions. And, you know, that paying attention and adjusting your process is craft. I sometimes wonder whether craft might be a verb.
I think it can be both, can't it, really? Sorry, go on.
Yeah. And I think, whereas art feels like, or the hypothesis that this guy had, the thesis was, art is something that has a one-to-one relationship with people, whereas design has a one-to-many relationship with people. So if you make something that's really functional for a lot of people, like a well-made chair, that's something, it's not art, it's an amazing product, but it's designed for like mass consumption. Whereas the relationship that one person has with an art form is a personal thing. So the artist has an intent in what they're saying with their message, but how you interpret their art differs to how the person next to you does, whereas how you interpret a chair doesn't differ that massively. And so it's almost like
an artist is more important in the final product than a crafter is. So the crafter doesn't necessarily need to feel like he needs to show off, but to kind of.
You don't need to bare your soul as a crafter. Crafters, there's in comic books, if there's someone who writes the letters, does the lettering and the letter bubbles and the speech bubbles and that. And when they do their job perfectly, you don't notice them. And I think when a crafter does their job perfectly, you don't necessarily notice it. You just take it and you absorb it and you appreciate the beauty of it, but you don't think about it. Whereas if something's badly made, you do notice.
So there's a kind of inherent modesty to kind of people who are crafters. Although I would only kind of like counter that with the fact that like so many famous crafters put flourishes. Like part of the joy of craft is that when you get good at something, then you're not just producing something to a template. You then add your personal flourishes. And then people can say, that's a Jamie Chalmers, you know, that's a Chippendale, you know, like, because you don't have to be invisible in the process. But I get the fundamental point that, you know, that sort of an artist is trying to say something about themselves and their view of the world, whereas a crafter is not.
And I think then you get brilliant William Morris and the whole art and crafts movement, and they all come together. It's just...
Yeah, and then the debate completely pivots and you go, oh, well, I thought we had it, but we clearly haven't.
But, you know, like... So I was going to say just about William Morris, though. I mean, I don't know much about William Morris, but I know enough to know that the sort of, or about the history of the arts and crafts movement. There's so much problematic stuff about that movement to do with, you know, that William Morris's ideas were really pure and it was about bringing craftsmanship back to a society where that was basically being ravaged by the Industrial Revolution. But a lot of the things that he was producing in the name of craft were deeply exploitative of the people that made them. So, you know, like a lot of his wallpapers had lead arsenic and things like that in them. They poisoned the people that made them and they poisoned the people that used them. I think his money came from...
Yes.
His family came from kind of...
Yes, he was one of those very sort of, I don't know, the socialists that there's something like muesli socialist, isn't there? It's got to be a new word like that. For someone who's a sort of desperately wants to be a socialist but comes from a very moneyed life.
I mean, I don't think that troubled him massively because I think, you know, to do philanthropy in the Industrial Revolution, you had to have spare cash and spare time, which was a privilege you could afford. And he did, you know, he did amazing stuff. I think he was a genius, but I just think everything's problematic when you kind of start to sort of scratch under the surface.
So when we first approached you about coming back to talk to us with great excitement, as we always do, it became very exciting because Jamie and I were having a chat about patron saints of crafts and giggling about patron saints of crafts, which you shouldn't really giggle about them, but it is quite funny that the patron saint of knitting is also the patron saint of sore throats. And we just thought that was, yes, St. Blaise, I think. Was it St. Blaise? We'll get to that later. But and then that became a sort of like we were giggling about patron saints of crafts. And then we were talking about the way that craft has changed over the centuries and the crafts that have fallen by the wayside and endangered crafts. And so we thought we must talk to you about this because, you know, your brilliant book about crafts, you have spoken so much in that book about crafts and it's got so many really interesting details about crafts that people don't do very much anymore, like coracle making, for example, which I love in the book. And, you know, and we also talked about the fact that blacksmiths, although, you know, farriers still make horseshoes, you know, blacksmiths make beautiful things for gardens now. They don't make functional things as a general rule. They don't have to make saucepans and cast iron pots or whatever else they used to make in the days gone by. So what are the top sort of endangered crafts that you've encountered along the way?
Well, it, you know, it's really interesting. So I think it's worth kind of just kind of thinking about what it mean, what you mean by endangered craft, like an endangered craft. I mean, so the definition comes from the Heritage Crafts Association, and they, I don't know like how long they've been going, but I suspect probably since the kind of mid 20th century or maybe a bit later than that. But they were starting to recognise that certain traditional skills that Britain is really well known for were disappearing, and not only disappearing sort of gently, but really rapidly disappearing. And that there was a danger that unless someone kind of pointed that out, they'd be gone. Because for a craft to exist, someone has to practice it, right? So they started to make a list of all the crafts that they could think of that people did in the UK, practical crafts, and then categorise them from viable, which basically means there are enough people in the country doing that craft that it's going to kind of continue. And then there's endangered, which means that there are not many people doing it, but it's still a craft that exists. And then there's kind of things like critically endangered, which basically means it's like two people or one person doing it. And then there's the awful category of extinct, which means no one is doing it. So there's a kind of like sliding scale of these crafts. And every year they release something called the Red List, which is basically what's happening to all these crafts and where they sit on that. And it's a bit of a depressing read sometimes, to be honest, because almost every year everything moves up a category, right? So something that was endangered last year is now gone to critically endangered. That's not universal. There are some things that have kind of been pulled back from the brink. I haven't got an example on the top of my head. But there are enough kind of crafts where if that one or two people stop doing it, no one's doing it anymore. It's really, and it made me then think about, and I thought about that, and I write about this quite a lot, is that kind of like, does that even matter? Does it matter whether someone's still making cricket bats or someone's making pianos? And so I've sort of thought about that over the last couple of years, and I've kind of come up with a couple of threads or reasons why I think it is important. And it was really interesting that you mentioned curricle making, because what that was one of the things that I kind of picked up on. And so that's critically endangered, basically. And does it really matter that kind of people are making these small little floaty, I mean, they're one-man vessels, basically, that are a kind of wooden frame or a very lightweight frame that's usually covered with kind of either animal skins or more recently, you know, something like a man-made material, and it's waterproof. And the idea was always that it was, they were kind of fantastically practical, because you plop them in water, you use one oar, and you can maneuver. They're massively maneuverable, but then you can come out of water, hike it on your back like a tortoise, and then you can carry your own vessel basically wherever you go. Which is like, I mean, it's like having a bike but for land, but for water. So hugely kind of useful. Anyway, so this is a slightly long-winded explanation of why it's important. I thought, well, why is that important? And I sort of started to look at the history of curricles, and they're sometimes called currics and different words like that. And I was looking at how the history of, I've just finished writing a manuscript called A History of the Countryside in 100 Objects, and it starts 12,000 years ago when the first kind of hunter-gatherers settled in Britain.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this one. Oh, I can't wait for that.
Even just because it's actually really odd, but the story of craft is the story of our country, right? And that craft is like the foundational stone of British culture. So curricle making, curricles, it turns out, were probably the way that the first farmers reached Britain from the continent. So farming, which arrived about 4,000 BC, was introduced by a group of people who sailed from probably northern France or somewhere like that. And we never really sort of, we always sort of wondered how, archaeologists always wondered how people got to this country, because they hadn't invented boats. We didn't have sailing boats. You couldn't paddle across the English Channel in a canoe because you'd probably be tipped out. And the point is also, how do you get cows and pigs and sheep and all that kind of stuff with you? And so this sort of beginning of the story of kind of farming in Britain is basically these groups of people making probably really big curricles, and, you know, women, children, husbands, cows, sheep, pigs, grain, everything going in, and then launching off into the unknown, hoping that they're going to find, you know, find land and be able to settle and stuff. And I just think that literally blows my mind. At the heart of that is that someone made that boat, and that it was a kind of this little simple craft, without sounding patronising, is at the heart of how our country was colonised, basically. It's fascinating. And then, so that was one of the reasons that kind of like crafts that you think, oh, well, whatever, you know, like that's not really important. Tell the story of how we are, why we are now. And if we lose them, or we don't understand what they're about, then we don't understand who we are as people, and we don't understand the story. There'll be big gaps in the story about us telling the story of the countryside or the story of how Britain was settled and that kind of stuff. So that was the first reason. That was just my thinking about that one.
No, no, I mean, that's it's so. But do you know what? It's wonderful, because I know, and I read something a couple of years ago. The British Museum said, you know, Noah's Ark would have been a coracle. And so you just, this is the thing about, you know, these things that you sort of, they're so ancient, these things that humankind have made with their hands.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And the word is ancient. And I mentioned it in the crafted book as well, that some of the kind of most heroic tales about human ingenuity and long distance voyaging and stuff like that have coracles at their heart. So I was reading about this and writing about this amazing chap called Tim Severin, who was a historian and explorer. And in the 1970s, he'd heard about this kind of legend that there was a 10th century monk called St. Brendan. I think he was an Irish monk, I don't know, who'd reputedly sailed from Ireland to Newfoundland, right? And that's two centuries before the Vikings even made it across. And people thought that was absolute twaddle. Like, how could anyone possibly bob across the ocean in a coracle from that far, those thousands of miles? And so him and his team built one, and he sort of launched himself off into the ocean to see if he could do it. And he did it, you know, which is just, extraordinary. You know, this tiny little vessel kind of sort of, you know, floated its way across to North America. And you think, oh, my God. Him doing that and him practicing that craft reveals that the story could be true. And then that changes what we think about global history and when America was first settled by Europeans, you know. So it's not just a kind of twee bit of kind of craft history. It's like, no, people have been travelling intercontinentally for hundreds of years. And that just blows my mind, basically.
Absolutely. That's fabulous.
I still like that fact that you had in the brief history of the world, according to sheep, without the humble sheep, the Vikings wouldn't have got anywhere. You know, those kind of just the little details. And suddenly you realise that, yeah, worlds are shaped by that. And then you see, you know, like Machu Picchu, you know, all these ancient temples that were built 1,000 years ago and we can't work out how. And it's probably this. It's probably like they had the technology, they forgot to keep teaching people the technology, and so we've lost all record of it.
And because it's really difficult to reinvent a technology sometimes. You're so right. We come at things with, like, especially kind of when you're doing things like experimental archaeology, which is a big part of kind of the archaeological world, where you're trying to work out how people made stuff or did stuff. It's so challenging to kind of think up and, you know, to like dig out old processes. And so people, archaeologists must look at, you know, these amazing structures and think, how the hell did they do it? Like, because, and so that's when, like you say about craft being lost, you don't know how to tell the story because you don't even know how people kind of practically did stuff.
Because unless that person goes, hey, everybody, remember coracles? Like once a year, in about 100 years, we'll have forgotten about coracles.
I don't know. And one of the perceptions, of course, that we have about the past, and it's one of those sort of like long held, really entrenched things, is that people in the past and sort of, you know, going back to sort of Neanderthal people and stuff, is that everybody's stupid. And of course they're not. Intellect hasn't changed. You know, people in the past were just as intellectual and clever and practical and brilliant as they are now. They just had different technologies.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the kind of stuff is breathtaking in its ingenuity. I mean, I don't really know much about ancient building technique. When you read about how the Egyptians built the pyramids and the accuracy of the construction and the fact that they had really accurate measurements and ways of building things, you think, I mean, that's a modern company building a skyscraper probably makes more mistakes than they did. You know, they probably work on bigger tolerances than they did. I just find it's really inspiring.
And you've got to wonder, you know, like we talk about the Dark Ages, and like you say, Mary, and we sort of assume that for some reason, and don't quote me on the years, but for some reason, say 200 to 800 BC, no, AD, everyone was a bit of a moron. You're like, but wait, didn't the ancient civilizations, weren't they really clever? So what did we do? Did we like eat too much McDonald's or whatever that version was and all dumb ourselves down and then have a reawakening? They must have been clever people, right?
Also more ingenious because they had so little to work with, right? No mains power, no mains water. You know, you're doing all these things. I mean, in a strange analogy, I wrote a book about farm here because I just wrote a book about the history of farming because I was interested in it. And what really struck me was how people did all the things they did before modern conveniences. So how do you run a farm when you've got no tractors, no running water, no electricity, no decent roads? No healthcare. Like, people were giant, you know, to do that kind of stuff because, you know, like, you had to carry every bit of water you used or create every bit of energy that you needed through some human or animal form.
It does blow you away, doesn't it? There's just the ingenuity. And I love the fact that, you know, going back even further than that, I always feel that, you know, when the first humans started to sort of spread across the globe, there must have been the same kind of archetypes that we have today. So there would have been the sort of the explorers, there would have been the navigators, there would have been, you know, the people who were really good at cooking. And there also must have been the people who were really good at homemaking and sewing and keeping things warm. So somewhere along the line, there must have been sort of, you know, and homemakers that sort of set up nice particular caves and had furs over there. And, you know, somebody would have invented a particularly nice way of making slippers. We have the same kind of makers thousands of years ago, 70,000 years ago, that we have now. And I love that we still have that root of makers, you know, the people who spent hours knitting and hours making things for their home or... That's the same archetype. That's the same maker there was, you know, inventing a way to keep your feet warm 70,000 years ago.
That's right. And then that kind of that transition of culture where someone says, oh, you'll never guess what. I've just knotted this basket in a different way. And look, it doesn't bloody leak.
Yes.
Brilliant. And they're like, oh, my God, look what Dave did.
Yeah.
And we're all copying him. And so suddenly everyone's making Dave's basket. Yeah. And then, you know, like that's a culture. And then 2,000 years later, you know, the whole culture is defined by that one bit of kind of craft technology. You know, the Dave's basket culture. I'm obviously being facetious, but, you know.
But it is. Yeah, it is. It is as straightforward as that, isn't it? It continues to be where people look at something and then think there's got to be an easier way. And then they generate that. Like with craft, you know, just... the way people invent ways of knitting in a circle. That's something that's happened, you know, this century, last century, that people sort of said, oh my God, all this double pointed needles going around a circle, that's really, really, really cumbersome. Let's invent this magic loop. And somebody did. So I think we still...
The boingy needle that goes around in a...
Yeah, with a...
My mum used to have them. Yeah.
And so suddenly we have, you know, that same evolution happening, albeit probably slower. But because of there's no necessity now. Well, so, you know, necessity being the mother of invention and all that.
That's true. Which is an interesting point to come back to endangered crafts, which was, it's a lovely segue actually, because that was the second thing I thought was most important about endangered crafts, is that craft is often about a really sensible and efficient use of materials and skills and all that kind of stuff to produce an end product. Which is basically what you're talking about is environmental sustainability. Like, so most crafters are sustainable in what they do. They don't waste their materials. They don't do things for kind of showy offiness. They're, you know, it's all about really clever use of time, materials, and because often it would have taken quite a long time to kind of get the raw materials in the first place. And I just kind of think that sort of balance of functionality and kind of careful use of materials is something that is kind of being lost. It's certainly from the kind of 20th century onwards, we basically rip through raw materials because we can, And that's a kind of, that's been one of the kind of really deeply problematic bits about modern life, is that, you know, you don't cut a tree down and think, right, I'm going to use this bit for this, and this is going to make 20 bowls, and I'm going to use the bark for medicine, I'm going to use the leaves as fodder for animals and all that kind of stuff, which is what people would have done. Now we just go, well, I'll cut this tree down and I'll have that chunk, thanks very much, for a nice bench, and the rest can
chuck it,
get wood chipped.
Yeah,
chuck it. And so the sort of endangered crafts, if you lose them, you lose clever solutions. You're losing solutions to problems that people have already solved. We don't need to solve them again. We've got the answers already. So I was an example of this. It's not really maybe an example of that per se, but so I've been writing about the history of basket making for this Countryside Objects book in particular. So the sort of Scottish Isles, Orkney and the Shetlands, but also kind of the Hebrides, and in fact loads of parts of Scotland, have a really rich basket-making heritage. And each region, and almost like town from between towns or between islands, everyone has their own vernacular style of doing something. And it's not because they wanted to be particularly fancy or they thought, oh, well, we're going to do it differently from our neighbours. But it's because every region had slightly different raw materials to work with. And every region was doing a slightly different task with the baskets. So say, for instance, like people on the Shetlands wouldn't have had access to timber or willow or whatever. So they made their baskets from heather or like the stalks of dock plants, or which they call dockens and that kind of stuff. And they could produce things that were so sophisticated technologically and worked for stuff like you could carry vast amounts of fish in them. You could haul, you know, kilograms of peat on your back in these things. And they're stuff that's basically made out of grasses and rushes and all that kind of stuff, which is amazing. And they'd have little, you know, they'd have different sized baskets for different things and you know, some had straps and all that kind of stuff and all that kind of variety. And all that is in danger because you can buy a plastic basket from China for £4.
Yeah.
And why would you? And also, you know, the traditional industries that they were designed for probably aren't there anymore. So, you know, you lose it, don't you, really, about when it comes to kind of craft.
I think I love the fact that basket making is peeping its nose up over the parapet again, because I remember as when I was a teenager, or maybe a bit younger, I had a bit of a spate of, you know, those sort of kits you used to buy with like a wooden bottom, and you just sort of do a little bit of weaving to make a basket and stuff. You could buy these sort of really horrible kits. But a couple of years ago, the lovely friends of mine at Lovecraft bought me a weaving sort of class. It was an online class, and you buy the materials, and it was to make a sort of platter. And we just sort of followed along with this incredible woman, I'll put it in the show notes, who does these sort of weaving classes. You can make amazing things, and it doesn't take very long, and it's so, I can't tell you how extraordinarily, I don't know what the feeling was. It was like, if you're a maker, you know, you get it. It's just that it was so satisfying.
It's kind of meditation with the hands, isn't it? Yeah.
And I loved it, and suddenly you sort of look at how these things are constructed, and so I mean, I'm really hoping, I don't think basket weaving's on the endangered list. I hope it's not, because I think people are getting more excited about things like that.
I was going to say, the thing I love about what you were saying there as well is the way that the fundamental of a basket evolved in relationship to its environment. And so, you know, in the same way as we see animals evolving depending on which part of the world they live in, it's lovely to think of those crafts changing. Like, I was always interested in like the different styles of lace making, because there are certain ones, and it always fascinated me that in Honiton in Devon, they've got a certain way of doing lace that's different to the way they have in Nottingham, for sake of argument. And around where I grew up in Bedfordshire, there was a lot of lace as well. And that, I don't think it was driven by the same reasons as the baskets, but it was definitely that evolution and that vernacular, which kind of said, this is where you are. And I think someone did, like in Ireland, I think they did a map of Ireland made of lace, and it had the different lace patterns that were prevalent in those areas. And I kind of love that. But then what you're saying as well, that like necessity-driven evolution of the craft is a really interesting thing to consider, because it's telling a story of the way those societies evolved.
And also, actually,
I was going to say, I'm the same generation as you, certainly as you, Mary. Jamie, I don't know how old you are. I'm sure you're much I'm 85. But I think we grew up in an era.
I'm not that young.
Craft really struggled with its image of, or craft was given the image of it was kind of something a bit twee, and it was something that you kind of did in your spare time, and it was a bit feminine in quotes, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so no one really took it seriously, or not many people took it seriously. And I'm sure there were lots of people, there were lots of people who were keeping on the good fight and keeping heritage crafts going. But what really strikes me, and even things like basket making, which ostensibly seem like a woman's craft because that's the way it's painted by society or whatever, anywhere you read about, it's so hardcore.
Yeah,
basket weaving. That physical strength you need in your hands.
Yeah, yeah.
And the dexterity, and it's so skilled. And I just think, like, almost people need to realize how, like, rock and roll craft is. I just think it's so cool, and it's such an amazing thing to do, to be able to kind of take raw materials and produce something so robust and strong and beautiful and long lasting and all these kind of things. I just think that's it's kind of undervalued, and I think only people within the craft world realize how cool craft is. It would be great if everyone else kind of realized how cool it was as well.
Do you know, I think you've really, really, it is really rock and roll. It is unbelievably magical. And I just want to just go back to that whole sort of sustainability thing that you were talking about. And I, one of the things that's just so interesting is how, you know, especially in yarn craft, granny squares are a prime example, crocheted granny squares, that they were invented by our grannies, great grannies, whatever, using up what they had left to make a granny square and not wasting a tiny bit. And actually, even as knitters, I remember these days it's quite frowned upon to change balls of yarn in the middle of a row of knitting, because then you have to weave in the ends in the middle. So you kind of try and time it so that you change the ball of yarn when you get to the end of a row, so that all the tails come out one way and it's really, really neat. And I was having this conversation with my mum years ago about this, and she said, well, you can't do that. That's a waste. It's a terrible waste of yarn. You know, you're wasting like 6-7 inches of wool. And of course, now people don't care about that sort of thing. But, you know, my grandma and my mum, that was precious, a precious commodity, and you had to eke it out as far as you could. And I think, yeah, that's really true, isn't it? Crafters are very sustainable in the sense of they, well, certainly in the past, would make resources really last. And people save all the sort of ends of bits of balls of wool and bits of fabric. And then you sort of go into America and think about patchwork. And, you know, this great, great tradition of patchworking where every single scrap of fabric was treasured and used and repurposed. And I was listening to something the other day on a podcast about fashion and sizing. And we were talking about how interesting it is that when you go to museums and you look at clothes of the past, you very often don't see anything big. You only ever see like small people's clothes. And this lady who was sort of, I'll put the notes in the show notes as well about where this was. She was saying that if you had garments that belonged to larger people or bigger garments in the past, there's no way in the world that you would just, they would get cut up and used for something else, repurposed for another dress, another coat, another something, another something. So sewers never would sort of take a larger garment and then just sort of put it in a chest and use it for... That's why these things don't appear in museums, because they've been chopped up and made into smaller garments or made into something else. So I think, you know, all the way along the line, we have been sustainable with materials and treasured materials. It is awful how much... I think we're coming back to that, you know. I hope we're coming back to that.
I hope so. But I think there's something more elegant about, I think that almost craft needs to kind of get away from the, you know, the whole kind of like recycling trend that was kind of massive, maybe sort of like repurpose your furniture, turn a wooden pallet into a dining table kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really worthy in a way. It is really worthy because it's about not constantly throwing stuff away, which is really frustrating. But in focusing on making stuff, cobbling stuff together to make something out of waste, something else has been, the focus has moved, and I think it's moved in the wrong place, which is about making stuff well in the first place and doing things to such a high quality that you don't people won't throw them away. Or having such an elegant, Jamie, you were talking about design at the beginning of the, you know, it being such an elegant design or an elegant solution that, like, so, okay, I digress slightly, but my grandmother was a milliner and she was ferocious about detail and ferocious about, like, design and all that kind of thing. She would have been horrified if you'd have made a hat out of recycled materials. She would have just said, oh, that you'd kind of cobbled something together from, like, the make, do and mend stuff.
Yeah.
Because she was a craftswoman and wanted to make something that was so beautiful and refined in the first place and so that you'd never need to even think about throwing it away. And so in a sense, the kind of like that whole kind of reclaim, recycle, you know, remodeling stuff, which is really cool. And some stuff is really cool that comes out of that kind of genre. Some of it's awful. It's just like, why the hell? Like, I've tried to make a mirror out of palettes. They're bloody awful. Yeah. You know, a palette makes a brilliant palette,
yeah,
because that's what it's for. It makes a really shit mirror, or it's not great. It's not great timber for doing other stuff. And so, in a sense, it's kind of like, I think we've kind of missed something. Does that? And maybe sound like I'm being a bit snooty about.
No,
but do you know what I mean, Jay?
That makes a lot of sense, because I think what you're saying is if people made things conscientiously in the first place, we wouldn't have the waste necessarily that we would think needs to be fixed, or things wouldn't break and then we'd be like, all right, now I need to turn this palette into something else. And I think that's the point, is the manufacture. Like, so there's a phrase that it was like, in lean times, tailors lived on cucumbers, and in busy times, tailors lived on cabbages. And the cabbage wasn't a vegetable, it was the leftover material from the stuff that they were making for other people, which they would then turn into their own garments and those kind of things. And I think it's a bit of that. It's like using everything properly in the first place. But like you say, I was thinking about when you were saying about your dad being a craftsman and making things with wood, and I sort of imagined he'd make you raised beds, but he'd make them with dovetail joints so that they never came apart. And it would be that sort of thing, wouldn't it? But it's that attention to detail where people would make things so well.
You've literally hit the nail on the head. And actually, it's got to the stage now where I wouldn't ask him to make those, because luckily I have a very practical husband who is actually a gardener, which really helps. So he understands kind of slightly cruder materials and kind of putting things together in a different way. You are so right. Like if dad comes and mends, say I've got a leaky tap or something, because he's brilliantly practical about everything, it will take 6 months because he will decide to dovetail join, you know, some kind of, oh, he'll say, I'm not going to do it like that, Sal. I'm going to do it better than the person that did it before me. I'm just like, do you know what? I'd really just like my shower mended. I'd really just like some tiles laid. Thanks very much. But
it will be impossible to remove afterwards. Such will the...
Exactly, but you've absolutely hit that. Sometimes it can be frustrating because you actually just want something. Sometimes kind of good enough is good enough, right? And you just want a job done quickly. But yeah, that's so true.
I was just thinking, based on that, is that what we really desperately need is to rediscover the value of handmade, rediscover the value of hand-honed craft, you know, things that are beautifully made and thoughtfully made and purposefully made by a person. And I think that just is irreplaceable, isn't it? We venture off into the world of AI, and AI is so helpful on so many different levels scientifically. But when it comes to things, you know, it's so important that we still have that element of handmade, and we really value handmade.
It's going to be a really difficult challenge for craft to kind of define itself, or we're in it now, but you know, going forward in a world where, you know, tech reigns supreme, and why would you pay 20 quid for a handmade plate when you can buy one from IKEA for 50p? You know, like, that's craft's biggest challenge, is, and the one from IKEA for 50p will be really beautiful. It's not like it won't be awful. And so you're asking people to see something in craft-made objects that isn't in mass manufacture things. And craft's going to have to really sort of like think about, or people who do craft are going to have to really think about how they sort of like appeal to, or kind of, you know, appeal to people's hearts and minds when it comes to kind of buying stuff. Because essentially craft can only exist if people pay for it and buy it and use it.
So now we're back to the endangered cricket bat making.
Yeah.
So I did a bit of research, you know me, I like a bit of research, and I actually looked up the Heritage Craft Association's risk register for 2023. So I'll tell you, according to their list, and you can find this at, I think it's heritagecrafts.org.uk/redlist. They've got five crafts that are extinct in the UK on their list. So we've got cricket ball making, gold beating, lacrosse stick making, mould and decal making. Don't know what that is. There will be a link somewhere. And
I'm just going to say mould and decal is the thing that, you know, when you're making paper, and it's like a frame with a sieve that you put into mashed pulp and you pull it up and it all the water falls through and then you... Have you seen that?
Yeah, no? Paper making.
It looks like a picture frame, basically. So that's a modern deco, I think.
What I do want to say is, if any of our listeners are thinking, oh, I'd like to get into a craft, this is gold dust, this stuff. Because if you can learn this, you'll be the only person. That's a monopoly, my friends. That's how you become a billionaire, right? So
gold beating.
Yeah, so unfortunately, yeah, gold beating. Yeah, this one's interesting. Unfortunately, new this year on the extinct in the UK list, mouth-blown sheet glass making. Now, I used to have a Victorian house years ago, and you could tell mouth-blown sheet glass because it's wobbly. It's like windows, isn't it? But they've got a slight wobble on them because they're not made...
Because, this is like a randomly interesting aside. Well, I hope it's interesting. But yeah, so in the ye olde days, when you wanted a pane of glass, you had to get someone to blow, just like if you've ever seen glass being blown, but you blow down a pipe, it blows a big blob, circle. What's the word?
Bubble.
Globe of glass, basically. Yes, exactly. That was then, I think it was then cut and flattened and it cooled flat, but you never got a massively perfectly flat surface doing that. And then when someone invented float glass, which is where you make beautifully perfectly flat glass by floating it basically as it cools, then that technique became redundant. But people really missed that effect, especially the kind of awful bullseyes, you know, that you get, that you see in kind of pub windows. And the bullseyes were like the last bit of glass they were the worst bit of the blown glass process. And people would have been embarrassed to use that in their window, but obviously it was kind of needs must. But you'd put that bit somewhere where no one could see it. But now, in kind of horrible kind of mock historical kind of with glazing and stuff, that bullseye bit is like the fancy bit. It's the bit that people think, oh, you know, we love that bit, isn't it? Isn't it kind of ancient and interesting? Mm-hmm. And actually glass blowers would have gone, no, like don't put that anywhere anyone could see it. It was like the worst bit.
It's so interesting how fashion can influence these things, yeah, that we would value that the bit that the craftsman would have said, oh no,
yes. Well, it's like if you're doing knitting and someone would say, oh, I'll put the bit on the outside, you know, like the knots and all the stuff that you hide on the back of knitting, oh no, I'm going to put that on the front instead. As a knitter, you'd go like, oh.
Do you know, it's interesting you should say that, because Debbie Bliss and I just recorded a chat with Tom Daly, who is a great knitter who sort of brought knitting into the public eye. And we were sitting in our chat and he was talking about a cardigan that he's recently made, and it's made of patchwork, and he'd made all these different patches and he'd sewn them all together, but because there were so many ends, he decided as a fashion statement that he would leave all the ends dangling out, and he cut them all to a uniform length, and of course it's just covered in ends. When he first told us about this, we were like, oh goodness. And then but when you see it, it looks like kind of Wild West fringe. It looked amazing. It's obviously like going to be like a couture type of looking garment. But you can see how those things suddenly become, you know, knitters in the past would be horrified, but modern new knitters would think, oh, that's so cool. So it's exactly that.
And that comes back to kind of, I should say, that's comes back to what we were talking about right at the beginning of the show about crafters putting their own little cheeky flourishes on stuff. You can, you know, even though they're supposed to be invisible in the process.
I'm going to do the critically endangered list. So crafts classified as critically endangered are those at serious risk of no longer being practiced in the UK. They may include, and I'm quoting directly here, it makes me sound very knowledgeable. They may include crafts with a shrinking base of craftspeople, crafts with limited training opportunities, crafts with low financial viability, or crafts where there is no mechanism to pass the skills on and the knowledge. Now, there's quite a few on here. I highlighted some that were relevant to my interests. Fabric pleating, frame knitting. The art of folding pleats in fabric. Like, I know a few people that do it. And Ruth, there's a lady called Ruth Singer who did a really good book about sort of folded fabric. You know, like just putting pleats in things. But there are ways that you can do it structurally and you can do it intentionally. And it's still quite a good...
Oh, like
kilts.
Izzy Merky, who used to do mega folded...
Yes.
...clothes. Maybe. Oh, no, I can't remember now. I don't know. Wow, that's fascinating. Isn't that amazing? That's such a specific skill.
Yeah. So there's also... frame knitting, hat block making.
Frame knitting?
Go on, what is frame knitting?
I wonder what that is. I mean, it must be like sort of some kind of looming or something.
It's the production of knitted textiles using a framework knitting machine.
Okay, right, yeah.
And according to... Sorry, I'm literally looking at this now. According to Heritage Crafts, then, it's currently practiced in Nottingham and in Leicestershire. The frame was invented in Nottinghamshire in 1589... The last commercial frame knitter retired in 2020. There are currently known to be three professional frame knitters. There are five trainees at the Frame Knitters Museum, two trainees at G.H. Hurt & Sons, and there are 12 serious amateurs, 12 experienced knitters, but none have their own frame. So they think that their total number of leisure frame knitters is between 6 and 10, and the minimum number of craftspeople required is 12.
For it to be viable.
Right, everybody, start looking at frame knitting. Yeah. What else, Jamie?
Frame knitting. But then some of the other ones that are new. Should we do new for 2023? Newly critically endangered. This is depressing. So arrowsmithing.
Which I can't believe.
Bow making, and that's...
I can't believe that arrowsmithing, because kind of historical recreation societies and an interest in kind of historical weapons is massive.
Yeah. But small, massive. I mean, this is the thing, though. Maybe it's that thing again where it's just mass manufacture on the cheap. You know, I think maybe that's what this is. This isn't really... Because when you look at some of the things that come up that are on this list, like flute making for concerts is on there. And you think, it's got to be plenty of flutes going around. Bow making, musical bow making has moved from endangered. Chain making, copper smithing.
Yes, because people don't wear copper, really, do they? That's the thing. Copper's sort of lost its... Zhuzh. Is that because it makes you go blue?
No, it's I suspect most of the copper stuff was probably to do with functional objects, you know, like tableware.
I mean, if you're into making copper arrows, like there's an overlap there, that's a double winner.
They just crush on impact. I think copper quite soft.
Yeah, I think copper is soft, isn't it?
Do you know what? I've got a copper hoe. That's like a little arrow hoe thing. And the reason that it's good is because when you till the soil with copper, in the same way as, you know, like humans have got iron in our blood and slugs have got copper in their blood. And that's why you can put copper down, because slugs don't like it, because it creates this weird electromagnetic thing. So when you till your soil with a copper hoe, tiny little bits of copper in the soil puts the slugs off a little bit.
Oh, gardeners everywhere.
That sounds like hokum to me, but I put some copper stuff down around the base of my artichokes to stop slugs. You know, I've got these big global artichoke plants. Mm. And I swear to God, the actual slugs saw it as a challenge. They just enjoyed climbing over it. I think it actually encouraged them, because they thought, well, this looks like brilliant fun. So they just, it didn't make a blind bit of difference. Yeah. They loved it.
Hilarious.
It's some really tough slugs. So
I noticed that coracle making's on there and critically endangered. We were just talking about that.
Yeah. Do you know what? I'm pleased to report, actually, that coracle making, according to the 2023 list, is just in endangered and not in critically endangered.
Maybe it just says curragh making, so maybe that's just the Irish version
of coracle. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's an interesting distinction. You're quite right. I quite like this one, and I'm just going to look up what it means. So moved from critically endangered. So this is just endangered. So, you know, there might be enough people, but people need to keep working at it. What am I going to say?
Brilliant cutting.
It was brilliant cutting. I love that. Is it just cutting?
God, that's
like
so brilliant. I have no idea. I was hoping you knew what brilliant cutting was.
Okay, so apparently brilliant cutting is cutting in a pattern into flat glass with a rotating stone wheel. The cuts are then smoothed with polishing powders using a felt wheel. See also gilding, sign writing, and reverse glass sign painting. So I guess when they cut into signs and then paint them, I guess.
Well, you know when you go to if you're in a city, and I'm sure it's all over Europe, but certainly in London, if you go into some pubs, old pubs, there are huge mirrors all around the world with etching, all around the walls, with etching all the way in them, sort of all curly-whirly etching patterns. And that must be brilliant cutting. Wow. Come on, artist.
I just love that. It's brilliant. Look at my cutting. It's brilliant. You're like,
do you think when you're doing your apprenticeship, you're just like average cutting? And then when you finally qualify, you're like, I'm brilliant now.
Yes, you've got to go through your apprenticeship of slightly rubbish, bit better, all the way up to brilliant.
And I wonder if there's like a post-grad you can do.
I would encourage people to have a look at that list on the Heritage Crafts because it's really interesting. It's interesting to see the ones that are at risk. Not only is it interesting just for seeing, you know, crafts that you might be aware of, and you know, like canal art and boat painting. So I think that might be the ones where people paint signage on the side of canal boats and stuff like that. I absolutely love that stuff. I love the way that like people are like the typography you get on canal boats and that kind of thing. So I would encourage people to have a look.
Funny you picked up on that because so that's a really interesting kind of relatively modern craft. But that's really specific about a kind of cultural group that's disappearing or disappeared. So canal boat painting, which they sometimes kind of call Castle and Roses, seems to have kind of developed in sort of a middle of the 1800s when, and I promise this isn't boring, but so when the canals opened in like the late 1700s, the people that worked on canals, it was basically like the HGV drivers of today. So it would be like single men or a group of single men who would operate a canal boat and, you know, they'd bez up and down the canal and it would be very blokey and it wasn't well paid, but it was quite a kind of valued occupation. And then when the railways came along in the early 1800s, suddenly canal work became really badly paid because it couldn't compete with the railways for transporting all the kind of the goods of the Industrial Revolution. So to save money, canal men then started to bring their families on board and their wives and their children. And so canal barges changed from being essentially like a big trucker's, a big kind of single guy trucker's truck to family homes. The kind of beautifying of the canal barge came out of families suddenly having to spend all their time in these really small spaces. And they don't really know where that tradition, like where the artistic tradition, because it looks a bit Romany gypsy, it looks a bit, there's a kind of European folk art in it, all that kind of thing. But it's a really distinctive style. And it was like their culture. It was, canal folk were really badly viewed. They were like they were marginalized and vilified, like lots of kind of marginal groups are today, and people were very rude about them. But they had this beautiful kind of like floral culture and strong culture of painting and interior design, and their canal barges were beautiful. And yet, because no one works on, or very few people work on canal barges anymore now, presumably that desire to kind of, although a lot of people, more people are on canals now than there ever was because of kind of tourism and that kind of thing. But it's a kind of period in time that's very kind of niche, isn't it, where
that's just
families were having to live on canal barges, and so you get the women and also the men making them more beautiful to make them more homely for their family and kids and stuff. But now that's kind of floating away and not many people are doing it. And
that's so interesting, isn't it? That's just amazing, because that's such a niche style, like you say. And it always makes me think about sort of Eastern European folk art and Romany and all of those things that are very distinctive, the caravans and the absolutely stunning. Mm. I love it. That's
it's so online.
I also appreciate the typography because it reminds me of like Grateful Dead typography, that kind of thing. Like you see some quite groovers, because I go and walk by the canals quite a lot because there's quite a few around here. And so did I ever tell you the story about one time that we were out with the girls and this is like 2 years ago. I've got photographic proof of this. We're walking along and a boat pulls up and it's called Flora. And we were like, oh, that's really nice. Isn't there a boat called Flora? Take a photo of it. 2 minutes later, swear to flipping God, a boat turns up and it's called Annie, name of my other daughter. Reality collapses in on itself. And I spend the rest of the day just being, am I living in a, like, is this an illusion?
Were you really hoping like Jamie then flood up the canal as well?
Honestly, we kept saying that. We were like, what if one comes along called Mr. Exit? I was like, I'm just going to kill myself. I'll ascend to the heavens. I just can't comprehend that. There is one that's near us that I quite like. That's just
called Lovely.
I love that one.
I mean, if anybody listening knows about endangered crafts, indeed canal boat painting or anything, if you have a story about endangered crafts, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at show@lovecrafts.com and we'd love to hear about it. It's something we could talk about forever.
I think it's really interesting because as much as we talk about the textile craft, I think there's a need for us to remind people. We can be that person going, hi, do you remember a coracle? It does say at the bottom of the article from the Heritage Crafts, that one of the surest ways to ensure the longevity of the craft is if the practitioners of it subscribe to the Lovecraft Show on Apple Podcasts.
Well, actually,
I'm just saying that I'm saying what I'm seeing.
The more that we all engage with discussion about craft, there you are, you're absolutely right, the more chance it has to thrive. We love it.
But yeah, I'm joking aside, and Jamie alluded to the point earlier on, which is that if there are gaps in the market and there is a demand for these crafts, oh my, that's such an amazing thing. You know, get trained in Castle and Rose's painting, or, you know, because there are a lot of these. I mean, I've got the list in front of me. There is obviously a market for some of these products. I think one of the problems is that a lot of these there aren't really a market for, or a big enough market to kind of make a viable living from, and that's a challenge. But some of them, like encaustic tile making, which is in critically endangered, so many people have encaustic tiles, and it's still such a kind of current trend for interiors. I can't believe anyone's not doing, like, presumably they come from Portugal or other great sort of tile making places. You sort of think, oh, it's such a pity that we can't do it here. You know, when there's so many skilled people in this country who could do them as well.
And whip making as well, which I thought was an interesting one, because you've got two different sectors of society that would appeal to. And if you're, you know, if you want to go
Absolutely.
Up a notch, don't you know, you start out with your basic whip for whatever reason. And then you think, well, no, I'm taking this seriously now. I want something to do.
I know, you know, on the back of the kind of the sort of 50 Shades of Grey, you know, element
of whatever you're referring to. I was talking about horses and ponies.
I was thinking the equestrian world and, you know,
all right.
Well, there are, you know, handcrafting of these kinds of items always going to be welcome somewhere in some little pocket of society around the world.
I think there will be some, just don't make any sense. It's a bit like the window glass thing, you know, and you have to have a forge, you have to have the ability to melt glass. You know, I can see where that's not when we think, oh, I'm a bit bored of being an accountant. I think I'll go into making massive sheets of glass. But then there's some things are like saw making or, you know, parch making and those kind of things. And they're not like really difficult ones to kind of get into. And yet, there's some traditions there. And I think sometimes if we've learned anything from the people we've spoken to, when you get into a craft, for any of us, when you get into a craft and you understand the context of the craft, and as you were saying, Sally, you realize that by making a coracle, you're part of a technology that has transformed civilization, or by owning a sheep, you're responsible for the Viking invasion, give or take time. You know, that I think that gives extra gravity to it. It gives extra responsibility. And for some people, that will just really give them a purpose and a passion.
And there's a big argument as well for a lot of these crafts are very much required to maintain all the kind of heritage structures that we've got in the country already. So, you know, lime plastering and, you know, knowing how to do wattle and daub, or, you know, hedge laying, or all these. These are part of the kind of British landscape, right? And they're the traditions and the skills that we actually still need. There's still a demand for quite a lot of these skills to if we want to keep all the beautiful things that we love about the British landscape alive and repaired and maintained. So it's not that they're not just kind of like, you know, dying crafts because no one wants them. It's just, you know, there is still a market for some of them, certainly anyway.
Sally, when will this book, this great tome about 100 objects of the countryside, when will we be seeing that? Because I know...
I think it's spring 23, so next spring. Some poor sod has got to illustrate 100 objects now. So that'll take a bit of time. And I'm going to end, because I've only just handed the manuscript in for that. But yeah, so spring 23, it should be out.
And
I'm looking forward to it.
And I always say this, whenever we have the joy of talking to you is I want to urge people to go and look at your catalogue, because Sally has written books on the most fascinating things. And we'll put links in to the show notes of all our favourites. And we first met talking about the history of sheep. But there are many more really fantastic books since then. I mean, chickens. You've written about chickens in the same way, haven't you?
I have. And it's not a farming book, I promise. It's a book. I'm really interested in how humans have kind of utilised animals over the years. And the chickens book, it's called Foul Play. And the subtitle is A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate. And the whole premise of the book is how did somehow a bird is one of the direct ancestors of the Tyrannosaurus Rex end up being something that we farm on such a monumental scale and treat almost like a non-animal, like a crop to be harvested that has sort of no feelings or I found that I was really fascinated by that journey, because also culturally, you know, the chicken and the cockerel are a huge part of, you know, Western culture in terms of Christian symbolism and our language and superstitions and everything. And so it was a bit kind of like, it's all about the sort of trick we've basically played on the chicken, unfortunately, because I am a big fan of chicken.
Or is it a trick that they played on us?
I have to say, they're really not doing very well out of this scenario.
I remember, because again, that was the thing with the sheep thing. I think it was as much about sheep have benefited, like sheep have got us wrapped around their fingers in some respects. I think that seemed to be one of the...
You're absolutely right. I mean, if you're talking the numbers game, chickens, there are something ridiculous like 54 billion chickens on the planet at any one time, which is a factor of, you know, many times more humans or any other species of the planet. In terms of, if your measure of success was how many of them you want on a planet, then chickens have done very well. But in terms of their lives and what we do with them, I think it's a
sad business.
It's a fairly tragic tale, really. But it is a bit, really. But my usual bonkers way of telling stories of finding like the juicy bits and the curious bits of history
Well, this is it. So first of all, our last episode, or our first episode with Sally, was season 2, episode 3 in April 2021. That was, look how long we've been friends now. I know, 2 years and some. But the thing I love about Sally's books is I think that they're books that you won't realise they're going to be as fascinating as they are. Because what Sally does is she takes a shed or a barn and makes you realise how blooming interesting they are. And I think that's your skill, is pretty much in anything. This is why, like, we haven't started the podcast yet, and we've been talking for an hour and 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so let's get onto the podcast now. Because it's so fascinating talking to you every time about this kind of stuff. And your books are just a paper-based version of yourself.
It's always such a joy to talk to you too, because you're so bright and so interesting and funny, and it's such an easy conversation. I love the fact we're interested in the same thing. So.
Oh, it's just joyous. Every time we talk to you, it lifts me up for days on end. I was like, oh, the books are fabulous, everybody, and you really have the history of the barn. Wow. But they are absolutely brilliant on so many levels, and you'll be everybody's best friend at the quiz nights, because you will have every single fact under your belt.
Apart from Scott.
If people want to find you, other than looking on Amazon, where you account for about a third of all the books now, where can they best find you?
I'm on Instagram at Sal Coulthard, because someone else had taken at Sally Coulthard, which was very annoying and hasn't done anything with it. Why did they do that? So I'm on Instagram at Sal Coulthard, and that mainly documents a lot of the stuff I do on the small holding here and talking about nature and growing stuff and animals and things. And I also have a regular column in Country Living every month about small holding and the good life. But if you want to find out more about my books, probably the best place to go is my website, which is sallycoulthard.co.uk.
Fabulous.
Go there now. Don't go there now. Leave a review of the podcast saying how much you've enjoyed this episode. Then go straight there. That's what we want. That's been great. I think we'll sign off for now,
Sally,
shall we?
Thank you so, so much. It's joyous.
You are so welcome. Oh, bless you. Well, take care. And thank you very much.
Ah, Sally Coulthard. I don't think it's, we can't say we have favorite guests because we have so many guests that are so amazing, and it's always nice when we get repeat guests. But with Sally, it's just like such an easy conversation. It's just, you just feel like you're just standing and chatting about anything that comes to mind. Like, it's amazing.
It is. So she is amazing. And it's like, what, 24 books? It's more than that now. I love her books as well because they are so accessible. They're so easy to read and they're so packed full of interesting things.
Yeah, I think she even produced a book while we were talking to her. That's how good she is at producing books.
Yeah, that's how fast. You can actually get The History of the World. That's got to be a mark of...
Oh, right.
I was going to say, I just think that must be a mark of success when you get your book is turned into an audiobook. I think that's amazing.
I think the thing I love about a lot of the stuff that Sally focuses on is like the thing with the sheep, and when we were talking about coracles, there are these things that we sort of take for granted that have had profound effects in the past, and we just don't understand that. We just don't recognise how civilizations were made. And I think I said at the time, you know, it's like now we see these ancient civilization ruins and we've got no idea what happened there. And you almost feel like as we lose our understanding of these historic crafts now, we run the risk of that happening again because we just, like, history wipes out eventually.
Well, do you know, and that's the point, I think, that she was sort of making as well. It's just that although we might sort of look at something and go, oh, ha, 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 no more coracle making, that's really totally pointless. Actually, it's huge. And it's only when you understand how important coracles were in the history of the world or any of these crafts, you know, just weaving, yarn crafts, sewing, glass etching, you name it, it doesn't matter what they are, but they all come from a place of evolution. So it's a very interesting chat. I loved it.
Yeah. And in the same way as people now defend languages that are maybe, you know, facing threat because of the homogenization of civilization and just English being everywhere, you know, I feel like some of these crafts might not be practical for you to build a coracle because you live in the middle of Birmingham or whatever, but that shouldn't necessarily stop you if it's something that resonates with you. And I think looking at the Heritage Craft website and looking at some of the crafts that are at risk, you know, people should have a look because you might find there's something that you didn't know would be interesting and you can have a go and maybe help keep the thing alive. So
definitely. Yeah.
If you do that, let us know. Email show@lovecrafts.com and tell us what crafts you save from extinction or what crafts you'd like to see extincted.
Oh, no crafts.
That was a bit harsh, wasn't it? No crafts.
That was very harsh. No crafts. But we would love to hear from you. Don't forget, you can email us at, as Jamie said, show@lovecrafts.com.
Or you can leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform, whatever that is, and say how marvellous it is to listen to shows about craft so algorithms can share that information even further.
See you next time on the Lovecraft Show.
Yeah, see you next time. Enjoy yourself in the meantime. Take care now. Bye-bye now.
Everybody, Ralph here. Ain't got a lot of time to talk. Some off ski jump practice. Just want to say thanks for being here. Be sure to like and subscribe to Lovecraft Show. And if you can leave us a review, that'd be bonanza. Right, where to leave my goggles? Layers!